So that meditation is based upon Tolkien's Legendarium. And in keeping with where we are at the moment, just as we're looking at the beginnings of the, if you like, the Arthurian tradition, we're looking at the beginnings of Tolkien's myth. Twice gone. Does anybody want to say anything about the meditation or any issues or questions about it? Because I'm going to go on to talk about the inklings and why we're looking at them and why Tolkien in particular shortly. Everybody okay? Okay, fine. So, what we've done, looked at yesterday really, and this morning, is the way in which we are embedded within a field of interconnectedness, and which has within it a field of a narrative, a creative narrative. And the narrative of our lives, just like the narrative of our collective lives, just like the narrative of our personal life, has the function of keeping us orientated and moving us in a direction. So the great collective myths, whether religious or not so religious, are designed to make sense of life on earth and to give a sense of purpose. They're, in David Jones's phrase, really, they are like the revered trinkets, the signs that uphold us and enable us to find our way when we're lost. And enable us, not just when we're lost, enable us to generate our creativity, to put our energy into things that have meaning. Now, in the West, and certainly in Britain, the dominant mythical form has been Christianity. Obviously, not just Christianity. There's been Islam and Judaism, and more recently, Buddhism and other Eastern traditions. But the dominant paradigm has been Christian. And as we were saying earlier, that because there's no pure tradition, traditions interact. So that the Christian tradition, as it impacts with the histories of particular peoples, particular histories, alters. It dialogues. It acquires locality. Now, if we think of Christian tradition in Britain, you know, it has very particular roots. It has very early roots in what could be called Celtic Christianity, and you know, the figure of Saint Illtyd was one of the very early Celtic Christian Romano-British saints. Because Christianity comes to Britain with the Romans. But it travels over time. It becomes the Romans leave and there's a great collapse, if you like, of British, Romano-British culture. The Angles and the Saxons come, and later the Vikings come, and there's an interchange between paganism and Christianity at many levels. Christians win So Christianity becomes the dominant structure. In this case, the Christianity of the Western Christianity of Rome, which by this time is split off from Eastern Christianity, just as the Western Roman Empire split from the Eastern Roman Empire. And the great, one of the big things that happens in Britain is the Henry VIII's decision to separate from the Church of Rome and establish the Church of England. And have himself as the head of the church, the defender of the faith. And what that means is that the reformers, the Protestant reformers, who, and we have a whole period of time and interchange where Christianity moves between Catholicism and Presbyterian and Protestantism before eventually settling down to be Protestant. Not all over the country, of course. Aspects of Wales, certainly aspects of Scotland, where the Jacobites are, there's still a lot of the Catholicism, and certainly Catholicism remains as a minor strain within British culture, but is a minor strain. What now becomes established is the English Church, very closely allied to the state, of course, because the king is also the head of the church. And what over time you start to see developing is a sort of Anglicanism, which is a sort of a social institutional gospel, not radical in any particular way, although profoundly supportive of the state. And one of the, it sounds like it's like a small thing, but it's actually quite an interesting thing. The Eucharist in Roman Catholicism is effectively a magical act. Once the priest blesses the bread and wine, for a Roman Catholic it becomes the body and the blood of Christ. And so the receiving of the Eucharist is the literal receiving of the presence of Christ into your body. In Anglicanism, in the main, except for certain high Anglican sects, it is regarded as a symbolic memorial, a purely symbolic act with no meaning other than symbolism and tradition. Now, in a certain sense, that takes the magic out of the religious system. It makes it an ethical system. It makes it a system that where people should look after each other well, and it supports that. But in a certain sense, it takes away the direct weekly experience of the encounter with the divine. And that's important in a way, because when we're looking at these much older traditions that we've been looking at, right at the heart of that is a sense of the generative divine feminine power, and the kouros, or the sacred king figure, who is the messenger and who gives themselves so that into death and resurrection, so that life shall flourish. So this is the root idea behind this figure that we find, who is the sleeping king, the red shaman of Paviland, the Christ figure himself, who's Christ the king, who dies for the people, the sacred kingship you find in Ireland and Wales and Scotland. All that, while you're still regarding that act, that Eucharistic act, as a literal act, as an act of encounter, is somehow implied, is contained within that. When you say it is not this is a symbolic act of something that happened simply in a long time ago in Jerusalem, then it's still potentially powerful and ethically powerful and cognitively powerful. But the direct sense of transmission, the direct sense of the encounter, is taken away, and that myth pattern that has lasted all these many thousands of years comes to a halt. It's there, but it's no longer being lived. The priest, when he blesses, if the priest in the older tradition believed themselves to be the living representative of the Christ and bringing the Christ presence literally into the elements of the Eucharist, then however attenuated the connection with the older traditions, there is a continual living link. Once that link is broken, then it doesn't happen. It can't, the connection doesn't get made. Never forgotten, many years ago, being at a Christmas Eucharist. And I don't know what was happening that day, but something was. But there was a lot of energy in the people singing the Christmas carols. And there's a part of the Eucharist service where the angels have invited to come and bless the people, and for whatever reason, that happened. It's like these inner gates happened, and this sense of angels coming in, and it was the moment where the Eucharist should have begun, because that's like the inner energies were aligned. If the people had come up to receive the cup and the cup and the bread, then something extraordinary would have happened. And this was the moment that the vicar decided to read the church notices of other services that would be happening in the week. And it killed it. The energy was just, the inner doors closed, the connection just didn't happen somewhere. And it's a sad thing in some ways, but it's also interesting that within these attenuated forms, there remains the possibility of connection with the deeper. But one of the problems is that we have lost the capacity, the understanding of what we need to do in order to enable that. Now, one of the reasons why in some places in the Catholic Church that more magical capacity has remained is in a sense to do with the Jesuits, who I'm no fan of, because they are the Christ's storm group troopers, really. But they... in their training methods, they go through a process called the spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius of Loyola. And what that involves is visualizing and imagining yourself in the gospel scenes with all your senses, as if you were there experiencing it. In a way, it's the same form of meditation that we use when we engage our imaginations and engage with mythical structures. So here they're engaging, of course, with the life of Christ. But what that means is, because they then have that kind of imaginal understanding of doctrine, when they perform rites, they perform it with that understanding, and so that magical connection is made. Now, what the inklings are addressing, so what starts to happen by the time the great event really within recent times is the Great War, 1418 War. And this is a time when Tolkien starts to write his Legendarium. Most of his friends get killed in the war. And he's interestingly, he is a Catholic, lifelong Catholic. So his sense of Christianity is very much a mystical sense of Christianity. I mean, in his letters, there's a very beautiful description of his encounter with what he believes to be his guardian angel, that he describes he described the guardian angel as a point of light held within the mind of God, that focuses its ray straight onto him, And in a way, that kind of little description there, really, of him communing with this figure, and through this figure, with this much greater sense of being and awareness, it gives you just a little glimpse for a moment of his own direct inner capacities. But he and the other Inklings and people like David Jones in particular, who went through all the war, went through the war as a private soldier. These are all people, Wilfred Owens, Sassoon, these are all people looking at the breaking of the world and looking at the literal, because up until that time, up until the that early part of the 20th century, we're still at the high water mark of the imperial colonial empires. Yeah, Western Europe is at its most powerful in some ways, completely dominating the world. The British Empire is everywhere. Britain is the great power of the age. You know, so and in a certain sense, this is the time when people feel that they have everything taped. They understand what needs to happen. They understand how to behave. They understand how the world should behave. And all that gets blown apart, really, by the First World War. And one of the things that happens in the First World War is the mechanization of warfare. It's a war that, unlike any other that's ever been fought. There are, of course, personal encounters and people hand-to-hand and all of that, but not much. Much of it is trench-to-trench, artillery shells, machine guns. Remember Ernest Butler used to talk about, he fought in the First World War. He was a machine gunner. And he would talk about the mechanical nature of it all. That you didn't really see the people you were shooting at. And then once they spotted you were a machine gunner, you were shooting at them, they'd shoot back at you and bomb you, and kind of, so this is war at a distance. And then when we bring tanks into the equation, you then start to get an even more machine-like, if you like, relationship to things. I mean, it's the logical conclusion, isn't it, of what war is. I mean, that's why the Romans way back along were so effective. They developed a kind of a way of fighting that was kind of, quite mechanical and involved training people's reflexes. So they were fought as a group. But even so, still in that, there is people fighting people, people having to kill people close up. This is suddenly war at a distance. Now, these days, war at a distance involves drones, involves missiles, involves planes. So the distance has gotten much greater. David Jones, in his book, in parenthesis, describes the First World War very powerfully, in a very detailed way. He was present at a battle called the Battle of Mametz Woods, which was a total massacre, really, on both sides, both Germans and British. And in his poem, he keeps referring back to the old Welsh poem called the Gododdin, which is one of the very first places we find Arthur mentioned. Well, obliquely, because it's one of the people who were killed in the Gododdin. So the only mention of Arthur is he was a great hero, but he wasn't an Arthur. So clearly stories about Arthur at that time that we no longer have access to. But one of the things that David Jones does in this part of In Parenthesis is he sees the goddess as gathering the fallen heroes, British and German, into, in a certain sense, we could say, into Avalon, into the place of rest. And what he's doing when he does this is to assert the primacy of the deep traditions of the imagination that are necessary in these profoundly dehumanizing places. And he does that very well. He writes so powerfully about the war and brings Welsh tradition and Christian tradition together into that to help us make sense of it in a different way. Now that, but this is, so Tolkien at the same time is in the trenches, is writing the beginnings of his stories then. He's not doing what David Jones is doing. He's not trying to make literal sense of the war, although of course he is. You can't live through something like that without trying to make sense of something. But what he creates is a great series of myths. That is about loss and restitution. And in particular, one of the things he's particularly interested in, really, is to create a myth of a story that has a direct relevance to the times in which we live. But not as an allegory, not as a simple how to address social issues. He understands, intuitively understands, that these sort of deep stories, deep myths, have to come from that kind of depth. And then there's illustrating, you know, there's one of the things that's illustrative of his actual writing method is, when he came to write The Hobbit, which is, I mean, he'd been working on his legends for many years before he writes The Hobbit, but when he writes The Hobbit, he's actually doing a boring job invigilating an exam and looking at exam papers, and found himself writing in a hole there lived a hobbit, and he didn't know what a hobbit was, and he didn't know what kind of hole it was, and he only had time to write that sentence. But that was the thing that set him off writing The Hobbit, which later leads to writing Lord of the Rings. And the thing that above all is interesting about Tolkien is that he is fundamentally a philologist. He's interested in language, and he's interested in the magic of language, the sacredness of language in a certain sense, and the way in which that beginning of the Gospel of John, in the beginning is the word, or in the beginning is the conversation, is the fundamental magical act. And part of what his legends are involve the fact that he created two different Elvish languages, which have their own grammar, their own syntax, they're loosely based on Welsh and Finnish but have their own and old Anglo-Saxon, and have their own but have their own kind of integrity. One of the things he felt, and I think probably quite rightly, is that Saxon tradition in England gets neglected. And it gets neglected because the Norman French, who actually are the literal masters of Britain, you can, if you trace back through the rich families in this country, they're all Norman French, because they grabbed everything and held on to it, and have held on to it for many hundreds of years. And the part of the reason why the Arthurian myth is so popular, when people like Geoffrey of Monmouth start writing it, is it was written for the Norman aristocracy to demonstrate to them that they were the true Britons, and so they had the right to steal and rule everything. And so, quite rightly, Tolkien sees that Anglo-Saxon and English tradition, as opposed to Norman, French and Welsh tradition, is not very well mythically represented. So when he starts to write Lord of the Rings, we begin with the Shire, which is like an English country town. And the hobbits are like sort of English country people. So he starts, in a sense, from what he knows. Starts with the hobbit in the home. But before he ever writes The Hobbit in the Hole, he's also been writing a whole series of interconnected stories. And one of the story, and so the meditation we used, which is, goes off to an island, this is in the middle of the sea, and then we come to the Far West. Now these are some of his earlier stories, and the cottage we came to with the tale of stories in his books is called it's called The Cottage of Lost Play, and the place where you rediscover story, where you rediscover the imagination, where you rediscover the connection between human and non-human beings. And this sense of the combined the tree of silver and the tree of gold, which we'll talk about a little more in a moment, but really it is about this sense of the primal unity of the world. And this sense of he uses silver and gold a lot in his imagery as ways of, and it's just, these are the alchemical kind of metals, really. And he's pointing at the potential, that deep interconnectedness that we find within the very early traditions we've been looking at. And the other thing about all his legends is he says these happened many thousands of years ago. So he's writing about the remote past. So in a certain way, this is his version of what used to happen in the Neanderthal days. So he would have said, well, before all of that, before all the history, even the prehistory that we know, there was this very ancient time. A very ancient time when elves were living on Earth alongside human beings, when elvish society and human society were side by side. When magic was visible and real. And a time which, and this is a time of great accomplishments and terrible wars. So I'm going to leave him there for a moment, and I'm going to talk a bit about, I'm going to come back to Tolkien's myth in the next session, but I also want to talk about Charles Williams. One way is he's much less known than either Tolkien or C.S. Lewis. I mean, he's the most occult of the Inklings, but he's also a very committed Christian, but an unusual Christian. Now, what Charles Williams is committed to, beyond anything that he writes, is something he calls the co-inherence. this slightly clumsy word, is connected with the idea of deep interconnectedness. To inhere is to be in, to be stuck together, to be involved in each other. And in Christian theology, the divine Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, are said to be in a state of perichoresis. Now, what that means is that they are constantly in conversation, constantly affecting each other. It's like the triads of the Tree of Life. So it's like Chokmah, Bina, and Keter, constantly relating to each other, being, will, and love. Constantly communicating, constantly generative. Now what Charles Williams says is this is how human beings are. Human beings are built in the image of the divine. So they are built out of this place of perichoresis, out of this place of continual conversation. So to truly be a human being is to continually enter into conversation. And if you, and he believes really, then literally believes in the process of us helping each other by being present for each other, praying for each other, and bearing each other's burdens. His image of coherence is the sense of the Christ figure taking upon his awareness the pain, the suffering of all beings. And if then you would be Christ-like, so do you likewise. You extend your awareness to another, you suffer with them, you are present with them in the struggle of life. And he wrote a series of 7 novels where he describes different forms of coherence. None of them are particularly easy to read, but thankfully Pam alerted me to the fact that they are now available on Audible. So if you enjoy audiobooks, I really recommend looking at Charles Williams' books and just listening to them. It's a very good read, a very kind of, it's a very Charles Williams read. He's got a very kind of educated Oxford English voice, which really works for those books, because that's the time they're written out of. And what he does in the books is take various occult themes. So there's a book called War in Heaven that's all about the Grail. A book called Many Dimensions that's about the Philosopher's Stone and the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. There is Descent into Hell that looks at the territory of the Klipot. There's All Hallows' Eve that looks about what happens after death. It's called The Place of the Lion is a particularly interesting one, because that looks at what happens when great archetypal images come into human life. The Greater Trumps is a wonderful book about the deeper aspects of the tarot, and contains within that a extraordinary image of Sybil, who's a Christian mystic, who is the fulcrum around which all the action turns. So Charles Williams is hacking away at here somewhere really is continually getting us to look at the ways in which we interconnect with others and the way in which we can choose to put ourselves at the service of that interconnection. I'll just feed you a little bit of his of War in Heaven, just so you have a bit of a flavour of him, really. The telephone bell was ringing wildly, but without result, since there was no one in the room but the corpse. A few moments later there was. Lionel Rackstraw, strolling back from lunch, heard in the corridor the sound of the bell in his room, and entering at a run, took up the receiver. He remarked as he did so, the boots and trousered legs sticking out from the large knee-hole table at which he worked. But the telephone had established the first claim on his attention. Yes, he said, yes, no, not before the 17th. No, who cares what he wants? No, who wants to know? Oh, Mr. Persimmons, oh, tell him the 17th. Yes, yes, I'll send a cent down. He put the receiver down and looked back at the boots. It occurred to him that somebody was probably doing something to the telephone. People did, he knew, at various times, drift in on him for such purposes. But they usually looked around or said something, and this fellow must have heard him talking. He bent down towards the boots. "Shall you be long?" he said into the space between the legs and the central top drawer. And then, as there was no answer, he walked away, dropped hats and gloves and book on their shelf, strolled back to his desk, picked up some papers and read them, put them back, and peering again into the dark hole, said more impatiently, "Shall you be long?" No voice replied, not even when, touching the extended foot with his own, he repeated the question. Rather reluctantly, he went round to the other side of the table, which was darker, and trying to make out the head of the intruder, said almost loudly, "Hello, hello, what's the idea?" Then as nothing happened, he stood up and went on to himself, "Damn it all, is he dead?" and thought at once that he might be. That dead bodies did not usually lie around in one of the rooms of a publisher's offices in London at about 2:30 in the afternoon was a certainty that formed now an enormous and cynical background to the fantastic possibility. He half looked at the door which he'd closed behind him and then attempted the same sort of interior recovery with which he had often thrown off the knowledge that at any moment during his absence his wife might be involved in some street accident, some skidding bus or swerving lorry. These things happened. A small and unpleasant, if invisible, deity who lived in a corner of his top shelves had reminded him. These things happened, and even now, perhaps. People had been crushed against their own front doors. There had been a doctor in Gower Street. Of course it was all untrue, but this time, as he moved to touch the protruding feet, he wondered if it were. The foot he touched apparently conveyed no information to the stranger's mind, and Lionel gave up the attempt. He went out, crossed the corridor to another office, whose occupant, spread over a table, was marking sentences in newspaper cuttings. "Morning, Ted," Lionel said. "There's a man in my room under the table, and I can't get him to take any notice. Will you come across?" "He looks," he added in a rush of realism, "for all the world as if he were dead." I really like him as a writer, and it's quite an old fashioned, it's really evoking, you know, suddenly you've got this English understatement, you know. I think he might be dead, you know, old chap. Oh dear. You know, and so that gives you one tone. Let me just find you another bit. Because this book is all about a silver chalice found in an English church, which is thought to be the literal Holy Grail. And the person who finds it is the Archdeacon of Castle Paliverum, the castle of the, which is a Roman phrase meaning the camp of the children. So this is an excerpt right from the end of the book, where there's been all kinds of daring do's, and the girl gets stolen and gets found again. And then at the end, a figure turns up who is the keeper of the grail. And who represents, in a way, that sense of connectedness, that sense of touching into holiness. And this bit of the book talks about just the encounter of one of the characters with this figure. She brought her eyes down to meet his without otherwise moving, and then looking past him, she came together, suddenly, took a step forward and cried, "Oh joy, it's," and stopped laughing and embarrassed. Her companions looked round in surprise. Behind them, as they stood clustered by the gate, stood an ordinary-looking young man, smiling recognition at Barbara. She blushed as she shook hands, but with her usual swiftness raced into an apology. "It's extraordinarily silly, but I can't remember your name. But I'm so pleased you're here. Do forgive me and tell me." "My name is John," the other said, "though I don't think you ever heard it. But we've certainly met several times." I know, Barbara said. "Stop a moment and I shall remember. It was just before I was married, surely." "No, since then, too, somewhere the other day. How stupid. Lionel, can't you help?" She turned a face crimson with surprise, delight and shame to her husband. But Lionel shook his head firmly. "I do seem to have seen you before," he said to the stranger, "but I haven't the ghost of a notion where." "It really doesn't matter," the other said. "To be remembered is the chief thing. I think I've met these other gentlemen too." "It's too absurd," Kenneth said, laughing outright. "But for a minute, when I saw you, I thought you were a priest I'd seen somewhere. But I couldn't at all fix where, so I suppose I haven't." "It was certainly in church somewhere," the stranger said, and glanced at the Duke. "At Oriel," the Duke said. In whose rooms was it? "But not lately, I think." "Not so very much lately," answered the other. "But you haven't quite forgotten me, I'm glad to see." "I don't understand it at all," Barbara, still flushed and excited, answered. "I feel as if it were only today. You weren't at the house, were you?" she asked doubtfully. The stranger smiled back. "I know Mr. Persimmons, and he will know me better soon. But don't worry. How's Adrian?" "Adrian's their son." "Very well, thank you," Lionel said. "Babs, don't you think you ought to get back? My wife's not been very well," he added to the stranger. "And I don't want her to get at all excited. You understand, I'm certain." The young man smiled again. "I understand very well indeed," he answered, "but there's no more danger for her here. Believe certainly that this universe also carries its salvation in its heart." He looked to Barbara. "We have met in places that shall not easily be forgotten," he said. "Before you were married, and since, and today also. Sleep securely tonight. The gates of hell have no more power over you. And you, my Lord Duke, because you have loved the thing that is mine, this also shall save you in the end. Only remember that in your heart, as well as your house, you shall keep vigil and prayer till the Master of the Grail shall come." He kept a step nearer to Kenneth. "But for you I have no message, except the message of the Grail. Surely I come quickly. Tonight thou shalt be with me in paradise." He moved backward, and as they involuntarily glanced at each other, seemed to step aside, so that no one was quite certain which way he had gone. Or rather, Lionel and the Duke were not certain. Barbara was gazing at Kenneth with rapt eyes. "It was he that was at the edge of the pit today," she breathed. "Tonight, O Kenneth." Kenneth stood silent for a minute or two and then said only, "Well, good night, Babs," so she gave him both her hands. "Good night, Lionel. I should certainly screw an extra week out of Stephen." He laid his hand on the Duke's arm. "Shall we go straight on to London?" he asked. The evening had grown darker before the Archdeacon, wandering alone in his garden, saw at the gate the figure of the priest-king. He had been standing still for a moment, looking out towards the road, and to his absent eyes it seemed almost as if the form had shaped itself from the sky and the fields and the road about it. He came down to it and paused, and words sounded in his mind. But whether from without or from within, he no more knew whether this presence had moved along the road or come forth from the universe which it expressed. The time is at hand, it said. I will keep the Passover with my disciples. Our fair sweet Lord, thou knowest, he answered aloud. I am a messenger only, the voice, if voice it were uttered, but I am the precursor of the things that are to be. I am John, and I am Galahad, and I am Mary. I am the bearer of the Holy One, the Grail, and the keeper of the Grail. I have kept it always, whether I dwelt in the remote places of the world and kings rode after me, or whether I have ever moved to the further parts of man's mind. All magic and holiness is through me. And though men stole the Grail from me ages since, I have been with it for ever. Brother and friend, the night of his coming is at hand. I have watched many nights, the archdeacon answered, and behold, his mercy endures for ever. Also I have watched with you, the voice said, yet not I, but he that sent me. You shall watch yet through a deeper night, and after this I will come to this place on the second morning from now, and I will begin the mysteries of my Lord. And thereafter he shall do what he wills, and you shall see the end of these things. Only be of strong and of good courage. So that, in a sense, is... these are two good examples of Charles Williams' writing, in a way, really, because at one level he's very straightforward, and he's describing a very particular time and very English time. And then he breaks into this extraordinary kind of visionary text, really, which brings us in, which is, and in what he is describing here is the keeper of the Grail, and that sense of the quality of the Grail, the mysteriousness of it, that and it brings us into that which does not regenerate is not the Grail. So suddenly we're intersecting something that is enormous, extraordinary, mysterious, that changes everything. And in a way, that's one of the great features, really, of Charles Williams's writing.